Hear now these words from the prophet Isaiah, written in the 6th century BCE to Israel returning from exile to their homeland. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you that have no money, come buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen so that you may live. I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. See, I made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. See, you shall call nations that you do not know, and nations that you do not know shall run to you because of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for God has glorified you. Seek the Lord while God may be found. Call upon her while she is near. Let the wicked forsake their way and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them return to the Lord, that he may have mercy on them, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Well, here we are in the season of Lent, which is our time of preparation leading up to the celebration of Easter. And our focus has been on practices of faith. And today we're focusing on the practice of healing. And as you heard, I'm here with artist and organizer Peter Brune, who's been working with our Urban Witness team, certainly initially on the question of how do we respond to the opioid crisis. But I've gotten to know Peter a little bit, and I know that what's important to Peter in terms of healing is the understanding that healing happens through our stories. And so I want to invite him to introduce himself and to share a little bit your story today as we look for healing together.
Thank you very much. Can you all hear me okay? All right. So my story, relative to this context, is I'm an artist. I'm a curator. I organize art exhibitions. I'm a community organizer and activist, and I'm also a father. And 5 years ago, after 5 years of living with active addiction, my eldest daughter died of an overdose. And several things came out of that. For me, was an immediate and extreme need to make art and to use art to bring people together to challenge stigma and discrimination associated with mental illness and substance use, with the goal of making the world a more healing place and for my own healing ride.
And so I'm wondering, what has been your experience of healing thus far?
You know, it comes from surprising directions. It comes in ways. For me, I needed to do things. I needed to do things for myself. I needed to do things out in the world. I needed to do things for my daughter. So for me, there was a need to share my story, to tell my story, to give shape to my story. There also were what I'll call other impulses that ostensibly are not healthy, that didn't feel healthy. And yet, in hindsight, that too was a critical part of my healing ride. And I think what I learned is when you are hurting, when you are in need of healing, you find yourself called to do things that you never would have imagined doing, be they large and ambitious in public or private and transgressive. And I think it's important to pay attention to those things. Mm-hmm. Not always act on them, but certainly pay attention to them.
I just sat through the class with you upstairs, and many of us wept in watching the video that you put together of your daughter, Elisif, and the 24 voices of people who had been impacted both by the joy of her life and by the trauma of her death, who are also searching for healing. And I'm wondering, you've chosen to be very public, and this has been a central part of your healing. And in being public, there are so many of, I'll say us now, so many of us who have also experienced some weight of your grief, a piece of it, but also a window into some of the pathways for healing, perhaps for ourselves. And I'm wondering about that choice that you made, and also if that's a true reflection, the way I said it, of those pathways to healing, of being public.
Yeah, for me, going public was critical. When my daughter died, immediately I was haunted by the notion of judgment and innuendo around the nature of her passing,
yes,
and the absolute faith that she was larger than her disease, and therefore the need to speak out loud about the disease, about why she died. My daughter was addicted to opioids and died of a heroin overdose. Was an important thing to say out loud because of the faith that the love and she was bigger than that.
Yes.
And so the moment I, you might say, opened my mouth, people came to me with a sense of gratitude for that sharing, for that giving space for love to be larger,
yes,
than the darkness of the shame and blame around what afflicted her.
Yes. Yeah. It seems like that one of the things that has inhibited healing for so many of us is that shame that comes with substance use disorders. And I think when we talk about that shame, we have to acknowledge that the church writ large has at times built a kind of shame architecture, which I think still today can prevent individuals from seeking the treatment that they need, but also prevent families from asking for help, and even in a larger sense, prevent real policies from being enacted that actually help people instead of blame people. And further expand the epidemic that we're in. I'm wondering what role you see for a faith community, particularly around this question of stigma and shame, which is such a barrier to healing for so many.
You know, one of the readings was the one with the fig tree getting planted.
Yes.
And I that immediately sparked a thought, and that is, the question in that case wasn't what is wrong with this fig tree.
Yes.
It's what happened to this fig tree.
Yes.
And what happened with this fig tree is it wasn't given fertilizing soil. It wasn't given space and care in order to bear fruit.
Right.
Okay? So the question right here in this church wasn't what's wrong with this fig tree.
Right.
It's what's happened with this fig tree, and what can we do to help make it better? And I think that that's the critical question to ask for those who are affected by substance use disorder. It's not what's wrong with this person, It's what's happened with this person, right, and what can we do to help make that better.
Right.
And we can do that in the faith-based community through messages such as the readings from today, or through your daily practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, too, when you and I have met and spoken before, you've talked about the sort of deep inner messages, certainly that people who are struggling with substance abuse disorders have, a deeper kind of shame that's even internalized, but also in your own work with your grief and in your own work with healing, that kind, the kind of instinctive way that we speak, even about the people that we love the most, even when we're better understanding this disease, this illness, even when we have that greater enlightenment, there's a kind of instinct or deeply ingrained reactions that we turn to. And you've spoken both about that, but also about the need to have compassion for ourselves in that. And I'm wondering if you could share more.
Sure, sure. So first, when you see behaviors that seem both self-destructive and destructive of others, it's really easy to judge that. Mm. And to not make a connection between that and a disorder. I'm sparking in several different directions here. I want to make reference to the fact that I called those who are affected by substances a certain way, substance use disorder, mm-hmm, versus addiction, or calling them an addict. Mm. An addict is something that those who are in certain fellowship programs refer to themselves that way. And each time I hear that, it grates a little bit on my ears, because that itself is a kind of, you know, you're not the disease, you
right
know,
right,
or a person. In terms of my own experience with shame, I'm definitely one of those through my lived experience who has traveled an arc from befuddlement, judgment, confusion, blame, to a place of compassion, understanding, and humility. And the humility comes from recognizing the judgment I once brought to bear, and I wasn't asking the question, what happened? I was asking the question, what's wrong? And so there's actually a shame that I carry,
yes,
in ways I have been, and ways I've contributed to an environment of stigmatization.
Yes.
And in many ways, going public is like confession or making amends. In this life I'm leading, I am making amends for errant ways I did not know better when my daughter was alive. Mm. I don't carry guilt,
yes,
but I carry the need to make amends, and yes, that's healing.
Yes, that's beautifully stated. It reminds me that in our liturgy every week, there is a time of confession, but there's also an announcement of grace, that we don't have to stay stuck where we are, even as we have to be truthful about where we have been. And I think you summarized that beautifully. That's the movement from judgment and from behaviors that we may have participated in that have been harmful to those we love and to those we don't know in the world, that we can move from. But we also need to be able to tell the truth about where we are in order to move to a different place.
That's right. That's right.
I want to talk a little bit about this text from Isaiah that we heard read second. And it was written, as I said earlier, as the Israelites were returning from a period of exile. And, you know, one of the emphases of the text is that a penalty has been paid, but you shouldn't stay there, that it's time to return home. And one of the interesting things, I think, about Isaiah is that it speaks as an invitation to community and well-being. It's this vision where everyone is welcomed into community and finds what they need there. And yet, Isaiah does speak of this vision as a kind of choice. Listen carefully and eat what is good and delight yourselves in rich food. Seek the Lord while God may be found. As Walter Brueggemann, a scholar, states it, Israel has a wondrous choice to make. either the new future now promised by God or more submissiveness to Babylon that yields nothing of well-being. I'm wondering now, as a father who has this wound, who carries this wound with you and has also experienced some healing, what do you say to people who speak about drug use as a choice? And to make it really just crass and concrete for people who say, haven't people with substance abuse disorders made bad choices?
Those with substance use disorder are not especially capable of making choices in their own best interest because of how the substances and whatever else may have come before, whatever underlying mental disorder or whatever underlying trauma, the brain changes. And when that brain changes, that's the devil of the disease. Yeah. Is it hijacks your ability to make the best choices in your own best interest. It doesn't mean you don't have choices. It means that you're severely handicapped because of how your brain has been changed in order to make good choices. I know we have people who understand the science of this much better than I do, but that's the basic nut of it. I also want to say, in terms of choosing community, those who are unaffected by substance use disorder have a greater power to make choices in both their own best interest and the best interest of community. And that is really where so much of my attention goes,
yes,
is to those who are not affected, to build understanding so that we who are better able to make good choices for ourselves, healthy choices for ourselves and healthy choices for others, act on those choices with the kind of message that this reading underlines.
Yeah.
Which is welcoming all, meeting people where they are, and fertilizing the soil for people's health.
I mean, one of the wonderful things about this text is that Isaiah is writing during a period of time where people in the community are arguing over what the community should be like, what it should look like. And I think Isaiah is a strong advocate for exactly that more inclusive kind of community that you're speaking about, which makes this language, I think, both personal but also political. It's a kind of advocacy to say, this is the kind of community that actually brings healing for you and for me, but for a larger a part of our community as well. So I see you very much standing kind of in the shoes of Isaiah, attempting to reverse some of the exclusionary practices of the past, where some were seen as outside the bounds of the community or not chosen or welcome. And you're inviting us to reconsider what a true welcome and a true community looks like.
I would like to credit someone on that notion. Virgil Stucker is somebody well known in the world of healing communities. Healing communities where those with mental health challenges, depression, substance use, go and find a community of compassion and wellness. He has said that he is absolutely passionate about healing communities, but what he's more passionate about is trying to make the rest of the world like a healing community. He also has defined mental illness not as this or disorder or that disorder, but very simply as separation from self, family, and community. So the moment you define mental illness as separation from self, family, and community, that invites a sense of duty,
yes,
to be a part of the solution,
yes,
by opening up the community as welcoming for all.
Yes, amen. Well, speaking of that, I mean, one of the things we need to name here is that one of the things I hear loud and clear from African-American colleagues and friends is a deep sense of anger and frustration that this more inclusive community, this talk of treatment, a more open approach, even though we're not really there yet in terms of actual resources and policies to make that vision a reality, nonetheless, that vision has emerged as white people have started dying, to say it crassly again. And I think that has to be named as we talk about multiple levels of healing, and that the healing that we long for those we love, needs to be inclusive of the very real harm that has occurred to primarily African-American communities in this country, say, over the past 40 years. And I'm wondering, in the complexity of that, as someone who has been touched deeply and personally, and yet also is now highly educated on these larger questions. What is your sense of that? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, I start by referring back to something we spoke of earlier, which is always making the best decisions you can based on what you know at the moment. And 5-10 years ago, when I was not aware of this issue affecting me, I didn't give it much thought. But now that I've learned what I've learned, it's important to make decisions into my future for the best interest of all. And I can't change. I can't change whatever attitudes or understandings I had before. I can only change based on the attitudes and understandings I have now. Right. And so the other thing I would say is it really is too bad that this is what it took. It's horrible that this is what it took for the larger culture to begin to bring compassion to those affected by drug use, okay? But it may be too bad that this wasn't happening 40 years ago, but it's happening now, and that's a good thing. That's an improvement,
right,
that we can all begin opening our arms in ways that we didn't know better before, and all I can do is continue this work forward, again making amends,
right,
for what I did not know.
Right. Well, and I think that the reality is that people across different racial categories are now dying at much higher rates. So the impact is across the board, and there are ways to go back, as you said, and begin to talk about things to repair communities.
Absolutely.
You know, based on the sins of our past.
Correct.
We're nearing the end of our time, so I do want to ask, what do you say to people right now in our congregation who are affected by this disorder, either themselves, their families, their loved ones, people they love? What do you, as an artist, as an organizer, most want to give them or share with them?
Very simply, we're all in this together. Quick anecdote. When I very first announced I was doing this thing called the New Day Campaign, an initiative using arts programming and public engagement to challenge stigma and discrimination associated with mental illness and substance use, making the world a more healing place. When I first announced that, I invited the group of people, and it was about the size of people. I said, if you or a loved one has ever been touched or affected by this, do you mind standing up? And what happened was, for a split second, about 10 people started standing. By the time they finished standing, everyone else in the room stood up, okay?
Wow.
Point being, you feel that this burden is shameful and your own, and that there are others who won't understand it. But the truth is, when you start speaking out loud, you discover it all around. I remember one of the events, forgive me, I remember at one of the events we had, there was a woman who I hadn't seen at any of our New Day campaign events, who was kind of just quietly standing in the corner. I introduced myself. She said to me, with the weight of confession, you know, looking like this, my daughter's addicted to drugs. She's in treatment. I can't talk to anyone about it. And I said, oh, so-and-so here has so-and-so here. And I introduced her to someone, and I'll never forget, I introduced her to someone, and that someone said, oh, my daughter's addicted to drugs too. You know, in other words,
right,
it suddenly became this safe space.
Yes.
Where it's normal. It's normal, and the moment you start talking loud about it, you can start overcoming that shame and isolation. Addiction is a disease of isolation.
Well, thank you, Peter Bruhn, for being with us. Thank you for your leadership, for the gift of your art that you are bringing to the wider community. I want to make sure that everyone in this congregation has a chance to visit some of the examples of that artwork following worship today, to see a little bit of what you've been doing, and also to come to the workshop a week from Wednesday, because love is something that we all experience, that we all deeply need, and that we all have stories about. And it's in that spirit of healing that I think we can share in this kind of community together.
Love doesn't heal substance use disorder, but it is absolutely required.
So the question that I leave with our congregation today, that you may or may not choose to answer on the index card in your bulletin, is quite simply, where is a place of healing that you long for? Where is a place of healing that you long for? And if you choose to answer that on the card, you can drop it in the offering plate. Thank you.